Okay, I believe I have everybody right now. So the... Maybe not. Who just came in? Hello?
It's just me, Ken, again. I just hung up by mistake.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, this is a joint Ontolog OOR panel discussion session dealing with the Open Ontology Repository research issues. It's Thursday, the 6th of August, 2009. So in this session, we are going to be focusing on the longer-term issues related to research, but can involve both tools and content development. So today we have six speakers. So looks like we're going to have to limit talks to about 10 minutes or so, if we can do that. And I will begin the session with opening slides. For those who have some trouble with one format, some of the slides are available in more than one format. So if you will, if you have trouble with one of the formats, try using the other link on the page. So the so let's begin by looking at slide one of the opening slide. It's entitled OOR Research Issues, Joint Ontolog OOR Panel Discussion. If you move to slide two, you'll see the purpose of this session is to discuss longer-term OOR issues. I'd like it would be good to try to identify, prioritize, and possibly even propose milestones in achieving some of these solutions to some of these problems. Both tool and content development are being considered, and we have an excellent panel today of six very prominent individuals. My opening slide also includes a review of issues, nearly all of which were raised already at the Ontology Summit 2008. So the panelists will be presenting their issues and positions. Depending on how much time we have, I might briefly go through a review of the issues that were raised in 2008, and then we will open up for discussion. So we move now to slide three. You'll see the six panelists. First speaker will be Michael Gerniger, who will be speaking about common logic support. Then Lisa Kendall, who will be talking about OOR for public sector use. Then Mark Gadarovich, who will be talking about uncertainty for ontology mapping. And then Matthew DeCan, who will be talking about ontology repositories and raising a number of important research questions. And Catherine Goodyear, whom I haven't heard yet, I hope she'll be showing up soon, is hopefully going to be talking about sociocultural awareness. And then the last speaker will be Todd Schneider, who will be posing a number of thought-provoking research questions. Okay, now the rest of the slides in the open of those opening slides are, as I said, the review. We will not be going through them until later, so we will now move on to Michael Gerniger. Are you there?
I'm here. Okay.
Okay, so it's time for you to begin.
Alrighty. Okay, so if everyone has the slide in front of them, I will be giving an overview of a project that we've initiated here in the Semantic Technologies Lab at the University of Toronto called CALORE, an acronym for a Common Logic Ontology Repository. And if we move to slide two, many of the ideas here kind of arose out of some of the earlier ontology summits. Now, we've already heard mention of the 2008 summit, which was on open ontology repositories, but there were other summits, the one in 2006 on upper ontologies and the one just this past spring towards ontology-based standards. And in a lot of ways, CALORE is motivated by all three of these issues. And the primary research question that we're trying to address in this project is how can an open ontology repository, such as is being developed in the OOR group, and as was discussed at the 2008 summit, how can such an open ontology repository support the integration of upper ontologies? So in other words, there are several of these upper ontologies, and it's still not clear what the formal kind of logical relationships are between them, and whether or not it's possible to use these ontologies together and to be able to integrate them in a consistent way. So that's one kind of issue. The other kind of issue is looking at what kind of support can we provide with the repository for the design and reuse of ontologies for existing and emerging standards. Now, one of these projects has already started up, if people have been watching some of the other ontolog discussions, with the units of measure. With Calore, we are kind of thinking of some other kinds of manufacturing standards that I'll discuss in a few minutes. But again, so the emphasis here is on supporting the design and reuse. So what kinds of, how can we have an ontology repository to support the reuse of ontologies that have already been designed? But when it comes to design, we also have issues of quality. So is there some way that we can use the repository to not just have, you know, being a place to post ontologies, but also provide a framework for evaluating ontologies and their relationships to each other? Excuse me. So if we move to slide three, the plan here is, first of all, to coordinate this work on this particular project with the current work that's going on with the OOR group to ensure that we can support the inclusion of common logic ontologies. So most of the existing work to this point within OOR, you know, building on top of BioPortal, is kind of oriented towards ontologies that are written either within OWL or perhaps within OBO, being kind of a biomedical domain. And so what we want to be able to do is to guarantee that we can incorporate common logic ontologies in that framework, and also to explore some of the issues that may arise that either are unique to common logic ontologies or which are more prominent when addressing common logic ontologies as opposed to, say, description logic and OWL ontologies. The second kind of aspect of the plan here is to really characterize and understand in a formal way what the logical relationships are between ontologies within the repository. Sometimes people call this mapping, ontology mapping, but it's just kind of in general, just what are the different kinds of relationships that we want to be able to characterize. Because this will help us to understand when we can reuse an ontology or under what conditions can we reuse an ontology or can we kind of combine ontologies together into a kind of a common theory. And then at the very end here, I'll just talk a little bit about some of the actual specifics to Calore. So if you move to slide four, actually, I took this off of one of the summary slides from the 2006 Ontology Summit, where, again, we were trying to understand the relationships between, in that case, upper ontologies. But really, these questions apply to all kinds of ontologies that would be in the kind of repository such as Calore. Now, you know, one of the simplest ones is just making sure that, you know, can we identify when some set of modules or some set of modules within an ontology or some set of ontologies are kind of mutually consistent. We want to kind of be able to represent the fact that one ontology is an extension of another one. Now, within common logic, there's an actual import relation where you can talk about one module in common logic within ontology, you can import another one. And so this is one kind of an extension. But there's an even more powerful kind of extension. And I'm not going to get into the technical details here too much, but it's this notion of what's called definably interpretable. What that means is that the concepts and relations within one ontology can actually be given definition in a logical way using the axioms of the other ontology in such a way that all the axioms of the original one are kind of logical consequences. So this is a very kind of powerful kind of relationship, and it's our kind of contention that that this is kind of one of the primary kinds of relationships that we'll need to really be able to characterize the capabilities and limitations of ontology reuse. If we just move to slide five, it's just this is one example I've used in earlier talks, too, of why consistency is not enough. If we're looking at relationships between ontologies, consistency is not going to be enough, because sometimes what can happen is you can have some very unusual, unintended consequences of your axiom. So these are three axioms in common logic. The first one says no one supervises themselves. The second one says that if X is a CEO and Y is an employee, then X supervises Y. And the third one says that if X is a CEO, X is also an employee. And the kind of interesting thing is that those first three axioms are consistent with each other. Right? There's no inconsistency arising here. But as soon as you add the fact that a particular person is a CEO, then you get an inconsistency. So as much as, you know, that's a great, great fantasy world that, where there are no CEOs, it's probably not very realistic. And so the thing is, the point here is that these two first three axioms actually entail that there does not exist a CEO. And that's obviously an unintended consequence of the axiom. And so we need to have tools and frameworks that allow us to really identify not just whether a set of axioms in ontology is consistent, but what are all the other kinds of properties they have. And if we move to slide six, there's a technique that we use within our work. We've applied this to the process specification language. We've applied it to this domain of ontologies called mirror topologies. And what we essentially are doing is not just characterizing when an ontology is consistent, but we're characterizing kind of all the possible models in a logical sense of those particular ontologies. And the way we do this is by kind of representing these models using other kinds of mathematical structures. So it's kind of what logicians will call relative consistency theorems. And again, what we're kind of saying here is that this is another form in a kind of a formal way of ontology reuse. So if we go to slide seven, right, what we want to be able to do with Calore is not only build this repository, but use it as a test bed for exploring whether or not some of these other techniques that I've kind of mentioned before, some of these other relationships, are adequate, whether they are in fact useful, and whether or not they really capture the notion of ontology reuse. And again, the focus here is on ontology that is specified using common logic. So if you move to slide eight, there's actually kind of three layers within Calore. The bottom layer are what we call the foundational ontologies. And these are kind of the ontologies of more kind of mathematical theories. And one kind of phrase we also kind of use sometimes is that we're turning the idea of upper ontologies on its head. Instead of looking at an upper ontology as being these very general abstract classes like abstract object, physical object, and those kinds of very abstract notions, what we believe is kind of the most reusable aspect are these kinds of very generic theories of mathematical structures, because they're the things that get reused. So, for example, there's the notion of a linear ordering. An example of that being, say, the natural numbers or whatever. Now, the idea is that linear orderings get reused in many different ontologies. They get reused in time ontologies. They get reused in ontologies of measurement. And so the idea is that's kind of what's common between those two ontologies, not some other kind of particular concept, but this underlying kind of mathematical structure. Partial orderings arise from everything from the idea of mereology, having parts and components, all the way to the ordering over activities within some kind of larger kind of process. Again, very different kinds of domains, but underlying that is the same kind of class of mathematical structures. So these kind of form the bottom layer for Calore. On slide nine, we see a second layer, giving the name generic ontologies. And here we see more of the notions of process, time, mirror topology, which is the study of parthood and connectedness, notions such as resources and products in a more kind of industrial kind of domain. And these are, I guess, a little more familiar to people who've looked at upper ontologies. But the idea being that the ontologies that kind of fit into these basic categories are kind of grounded in the other foundational ontologies. And so, again, we can see we not only then would use those foundational ontologies to prove that these generic ontologies are consistent, but we can also use them to characterize all the different kinds of models and be able to identify potentially unintended consequences of the actions that are in these different kinds of ontologies. On slide 10 is where we get to the kind of the top layer. Here, where this is kind of most relevant to the ontology summit this past spring, because what we're really after here are not just, you know, we're not just building this repository just to have an archive on the web for common logic ontologies. We really want to use this to develop ontologies for either existing manufacturing standards or kind of emerging manufacturing standards, and to be able to understand how can all these other ontologies be integrated together to provide the definitions for the concepts that are in these manufacturing standards. So this will kind of be the test of whether or not we have enough ontologies in the repository, because that's kind of the goal that we have here. That's kind of another thing, right? This is going to be kind of the ontologies that will be appearing in CALORI will be driven by the ontologies that we need to provide the definitions for concepts in these manufacturing standards that we identify. So it's very driven by the end application here. Slide 11 just kind of gives a little picture of what I had before, the three different layers, so we can flip over that. And that's about it. I think I'm out of time here. But in the near term, what we want to do is to incorporate the current common logic ontologies that we have been working with in our lab, ranging from the process specification language to on-time ontologies, mirror topologies and others, and all the other kind of underlying mathematical theories that are associated with them. But the real, you know, key test here or key objective here is to use CALORI again as a test bed for both ontology evaluation, so we're addressing quality, but also all these other kinds of integration techniques, whether you look at them as being ontology mappings or simply relationships between ontologies. But that's kind of the key focus. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. So I think this is really very important work you're doing. I personally am really intrigued by this idea of relative consistency, which could be really relevant to, I think, some of the questions that will be coming up shortly. Now, our next speaker is Lisa Kendall. Lisa, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
So, actually, Michael's presentation was a very nice introduction to some of the questions that I'm going to raise. Most of the work that we've been doing recently has been with organizations like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and some DARPA research, where the government really is interested in creating metadata and model repositories for managing not only ontologies but related assets. So, for example, ontologies that describe vocabularies for various aspects of multi-mission ground data systems at JPL, and then reusing those same models as a basis for software development so that the terminology is consistent across their software applications, as just one example. And so the concern there is not only to be able to create repositories internally, and that they would initially share with their other NASA and university partners on some of the multi-mission efforts they participate in, but the software assets, some of the other kinds of models, mathematical models, models of planetary science data and that sort of thing, they would keep all of those things together, relate them to one another, be able to describe their interdependencies, and then have a much richer repository for sharing that kind of information or creating a legacy for downstream use. JPL in particular is in the process of software modernization for their whole ground data system segment, and that includes both their deep space networking organization, which is responsible for all the communications from the ground to the various spacecraft they manage, as well as what they call their multi-mission operation systems which provide the ground segment that works with those communications capabilities to collect and both to task the spacecraft and then to collect the resulting science data for distribution to scientists. So, for example, one problem that's a huge thorn for them that we are investigating is data accountability. From the time you send some kind of a command to a spacecraft that a scientist wants some information captured, to the time you actually return that content back to the scientist. And there are many, many steps along the way and issues like, okay, the spacecraft is on the other side of the planet, we can't talk to it right now, or we have huge power issues we have to manage because the solar panel on one side of the spacecraft is dying, or something else. And so they have an incredible array of models, as you might expect, for all of these kinds of things. And being able to use common terminology and the same ontology across the software that actually describes these things is something that they are very seriously considering. But in order to do that, you need to make the registry of these ontologies and of the related models available across the organization and to be shared with their partners. And so that is really the framework for what I'm talking about here and some of the requirements we've presented before, but I want to put them in context so that you get a better sense of how real this is becoming and how important a problem it is. So let's look at slide two really quickly. What we have discovered and what is very clear at JPL and also on some of our other DARPA activities is that most ontologies are really developed for some specific purpose. While I think the general cases that Michael mentioned are extremely important as a basis for this work, a lot of the things that we are seeing so far in the places where people try to tackle problems tend to be either kind of in higher level or what I'll call middle layers or application level. And so what doesn't typically happen is development assumptions are not made explicit, and when you look at one of these ontologies or some of the related models, it's very hard to know what assumptions were made by the developer coming in from the outside. The research ontologies we've looked at, and there are some at JPL included here, tend to be focused on the demonstration content, and so they are somewhat incomplete. The level of coverage and granularity depends on what their funding limitations were for the development process. Mm. Some of the more recent ones we've looked at, and specifically those involved in the bioinformatics community, to get a sense of methodology that we should be applying at JPL, for example, are more complete, are better documented, but do have domain focus, including with respect to the methodology. And even with common metadata, since the planetary data store at JPL uses a registry framework based on an early version of ISO 11179, without that design intent, the research and reuse of these ontologies is really difficult. Slide three, please. So what is needed, one of the many things that is needed, is some kind of explicit set of policies for managing these things. And I believe that in addition to having the repository, we really need to make these policies explicit with respect to any ontology that we anticipate would be shared. I did a study a few years back with the Semantic Web Deployment Working Group at W3C to look at what made some ontologies and vocabularies reusable. And you see a list here on the screen. I'm not going to walk through all of those, but I will focus on one. And that is the Finanto project, which is large and growing. And one of the most interesting features of this project is that it has a small number of, small-ish number of developers, but a very large and growing community of people who are interested in it and who provide consistent feedback on it. And the reason it's the only national project of this kind that I'm aware of, at any rate, and maybe some of you know of others, is that they believe that their culture is dying. And so this is an effort of those people who really have ownership and cultural heritage that they want to make available to their colleagues, peers, and children. Actively available because they're very concerned that if they don't do this, it will disappear. So they have a very personal reason for making this an effective and reusable environment, framework and set of ontologies, vocabularies, descriptions, and information that they're making available to the public in general, but specifically to their own community. And so if you go to that link, you'll see there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. So some critical factors for reuse that we've identified appear to be a small set of developers and a much larger community, but with this continuous feedback loop where the community has the opportunity to provide input to the developers, where there is a feedback loop where they feel like their input has been acknowledged, where their activities, no matter how naive or sophisticated, are absolutely respected, and then that public documentation of their maintenance policies is essential. So slide four, please. So some of the practices that we considered in W3C and that seem to be very important include really well-specified policies for how you're going to manage your vocabulary, how it's going to change, how people can trust it, and how they can trust it over time. That's incredibly important for any public sector use, but also, I would argue, for any corporate use of a set of ontologies that you might develop and place in a repository like the OOR. The commitment to serving your community of users from an individual ontology perspective as well as the perspective of the OOR is incredibly important. There are only a few portals out there that I think exemplify or are starting to exemplify some of these things, and the BioPortal is one. So I've listed just the short list of the things that we had identified in the W3C for a minimal set of principles that need to be articulated. But I think there's a lot more, and in particular with respect to provenance and with respect to what your usage policies are, what your IPR policies are, what your maintenance strategies are, in order for people to really trust those ontologies that you're putting out there and the value of the repository that you're creating. It needs to be a living repository. It needs to continuously evolve. You need to understand whether or not those ontologies that participate in this process are also evolving, which mappings from which versions of which ontologies apply at a given point in time, and so forth. Slide five, please. I include here some lessons learned from ISO-STEP, which I know Michael is very familiar with, and I'm assuming that other folks on the call may be as well. But designing for reuse is critical, both in terms of the ontologies themselves and in the policies and metadata that we create for them that are managed in the OOR. And so I give you this just as examples of things that were noted in the STEP community. There's a lot of documentation out there on ISO-STEP, APT-10, and other components of the STEP standard that you might take a look at as a basis for thinking along these lines. The size of models is critical. How you organize those models is critical. How you make them reusable, what the dependencies are, and how you specify what those dependencies are up front. All of those things are incredibly important for enabling people to reuse a set of ontologies together that might be in your repository. I also, on slide six, have listed some essential metadata requirements. Some of this comes out of work that we've done and that my colleague Deborah McGinnis has done in her Inference Web project. And here, understanding the sources, creation and revision information, down to the fact level, down to the individual level in your ontology, regardless of the representation language, is really critical in order to understand when you take multiple ontologies and query across them together where your results are coming from and that sort of thing. And so we have a short list of some of those things. Actually, for JPL and for DARPA, we've started to create a metadata crosswalk which compares and contrast some of the properties in JPL Core and Taxonomy and NASA Taxonomy metadata elements, as well as metadata from ISO 11179, from what was originally the Government Information Locator Service that's still in use by FirstGov, for the ontology metadata vocabulary from OMD from Karlsruhe, the PML specification language, the proof markup language from the Inference Web work, and other things. And we have a starting point for that that is pretty strong that we're planning to use for our metadata repository for JPL. And I will look for permission from them before I can share it with you all, but it's fairly rich. It reflects a number of naming conventions that we've adopted so that the names and terms and GUIDs and other things that you use in defining your ontology elements are usable across multiple tools and model representations, for example. And so with their permission, I will look to try to make that usable for this group as part of their development process. But a lot more research is needed to really understand what pieces of that crosswalk are really required, who really cares about certain kinds of dependencies and who does not, how we make these things sufficiently modular so that reuse by folks from various domains is possible. All those questions, I think, open the door for a lot more work and probably for a number of PhD theses if you all have students or know of people who want to do that kind of research. And finally, on my last slide, slide 7, I have some links for you to some of the things that we've used in developing this crosswalk, and not all, but most of the pieces that we've looked at that were very general that are out there are listed on and linked on this slide. If you're very interested in the JPL application in particular, you might also go to the NASA and JPL websites, and some of the content of the JPL taxonomy, for example, is available publicly, and some of the search criteria that you use on their site and on the NASA website is driven by that taxonomy. So there are papers and other things out there by some of our colleagues at NASA and JPL, but also their site is definitely driven by these taxonomies, and so I encourage you to look. And if you search on the JPL taxonomy, I believe Jane Dutra and others have given papers on at least some of their early findings in developing that. And with that, I hand it over to Seneca.
Thank you, Lisa. You've brought a lot of material. It's going to take a long time to digest them.
My typical fire hose, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. Hopefully we can make up some of our lost time. But it was definitely well worth it. Art, your turn. Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me? Okay, great. Thanks, Ben. My name is Art Gajerovich, and I'm looking at the ways to utilize uncertainty for automated ontology mapping. And I'm looking to build some modules for OR to be able to do this. So if we go on to slide number 2, my motivation here is basically looking at some of the issues that were raised by both Michael and Lisa, and having a sort of a closed world knowledge repository, so domain-specific ontologies, and having them open to the open world, to everyone else, to be able to reuse them and share their information. So the way I see it is to achieve this in a more mechanical fashion is to do it through sort of some machine learning algorithms. And for that, I'm looking at introducing a sort of fuzzy or probabilistic uncertainty to the ontologies to be able to do that. Now, because of this, these ontologies would be limited to ones with data sets with vast amounts of data that represent these ontologies. We're speaking about the BioPortal Library last presentation, where there's 140 ontologies, there's 70,000 classes, 30,000 mappings, and this is growing. So this is just one repository. But all the ones that Lisa just mentioned, they're all able to be shared. So if we go on to slide three, so some of the capabilities I would like to introduce in this work are be able to compare incoming ontologies to the ones in the repository already, identify some similarities, identify similar work and propose collaboration, so make it a conversation, not just a tool. Possibly combine these ontologies to reduce duplication, and add a new dimension of search on a more generalized set of information or set of criteria. And also to introduce fuzzy and probabilistic reasoning on these ontologies within the repository. Moving on to slide four, some of the activities I set out for myself and for this work is researching and developing these mapping algorithms, which use these uncertainty measures. Introducing uncertainty to the existing logics and languages required and supported by the repositories, and again, developing libraries to put this capability in OOR. So moving on to incorporate some of this, some of the mapping mechanisms in BioPortal already, and presumably in OOR, to be able to handle these sort of uncertain measures for this. One of the directions I was looking at was integrating it with the URW3 initiative that has actually built an upstream ontology and built that into the mapping tools. And moving on to slide five. So developing this for the different logics required. So first order, which would be just at the meta level information. And description logic, which would hopefully introduce more advanced techniques and tools, and also to support the different languages required, so OWL, LDF, Algorithm Common Logic, and the OBO and the Protégé frame language. And that is it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Bart. That was very interesting. There are really kind of two issues here. One of them is just introducing uncertainty reasoning, which I presume could be done with just appropriate ontology, although even that is quite clear. But then there's the question of how we would incorporate that into the mapping mechanism. So it's certainly a very interesting research problem you have there.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. If any individuals have come in a little late, could you make sure that your phone is muted? So we don't get any background noise during the talk. I believe muting is star 2, whereas unmuting is star 3. Okay, our next speaker, Matthew, are you there?
Yes.
Great. I was going to be giving us some interesting discussion and perspectives about ontology repositories. Matthew.
Okay, hi. My name is Mathieu Dacquin, and I work at the Open University in the UK. And I've been presenting my work quite a bit. I've developed the Watson search engine for ontologies, and also I'm currently developing the Cobalt ontology repository system. But since I presented that quite a bit, I wanted to have a bit more general discussion on more ongoing work and research perspective on ontology repositories in general, including OR. And looking at the broad area of ontology repositories, you can see that there are a lot of going on to site too. So, you can see that there are a lot of existing systems which take into account different languages, different functionalities, different communities. And if you go into slide 3, what you can see is that although there are lots of differences, they share a lot of their features. Most of them you can upload and submit ontologies. This is quite obvious, and you can do that in either a single space where all the ontologies are shared by everybody. In multiple spaces, some of them you can have specific groups of ontologies, or you can have ontologies submitted by particular users. And there is some form of validation of the ontologies that are being submitted. You can browse and search ontologies into the entire ontology collection or individual ontologies. You can often provide description of ontologies, metadata, documentation, statistics and metrics on ontologies in many of them. You can also retrieve the ontologies, and very often they provide programmatic access to the ontology. Now, what I'm more interested in is in slide 4, is what is missing in this landscape of ontology repositories. And one thing that strikes me particularly is that there is a lack of structure. There are many other things that can be discussed and that seem to be missing, but there is certainly a problem with the interaction with the user. In the end, ontology repositories seem to be designed as a way to collect ontologies, but not necessarily as a way to help users, help people and ontology engineers in finding suitable ontologies, and here, of course, by suitable, I mean reusable or at least exploitable ontologies. Now, there is also a certain lack of structure in the collection of ontologies that is there, meaning most of the ontology repositories provide a list of ontologies, a set of ontologies, which is an order. There is no relation between ontologies. There is no organization between these ontologies. And there's a previous presentations already mentioned that there is this need to represent the links that are shared by different ontologies. And finally, there is no structure in the collection of repositories themselves. I mean, there is, to me, certainly a big issue in the fact that most of these repository systems are developed in mostly isolated from each other and can't really work together in providing access to reusable ontologies. So I said there is many other things, but these are the elements I would like to discuss a bit, or to at least engage discussion on. So concerning the interaction with the user on slide 5, supporting users in finding ontologies is becoming a very hard issue. Most of the repositories include search engines, which can type keywords and get ontologies. It's very clear to me that these are not efficient, and they are advanced search mechanisms. You can search for particular elements of ontology in particular places, but still, this doesn't tell you whether the ontology fits your needs and will work properly and will be reusable. Now, a number of ontology repositories use metrics and measures for different aspects of ontologies, which hopefully should be useful and interesting aspects for the user to find if the ontology is appropriate. But again, this is extremely hard to define. What is an appropriate metric and how to interpret a metric? I mean, what the size, the connectivity, or the density of an ontology could possibly mean is very hard to define. And at the same time, what are the the suitable metrics to apply depends a lot on the application and on the context where the ontology is supposed to be released. So all the approach concern ontology rating and reviews, which means asking the user to provide evaluation of the ontology. This is one of the things we do. And but of course, there is an obvious downside to that, apart from the fact that, again, reviews and evaluation of ontologies depend on what you want to do with it, is that it's kind of hard to ask users to review ontologies. Providing evaluation of ontologies is a very hard task, and it's difficult to find incentives for users to do that. Now, rich metadata for ontology has been mentioned, and this is one of the obvious ways to help users in finding the right one. And finally, the one thing which is interesting is that one way to help somebody to understand if an ontology is appropriate for his or her needs is to provide suitable summaries of ontologies. And this is something pretty hard to do. If you look at slide 6, this shows what we do with the Cobalt system, where we have very rich metadata based on the OMD format. We also have user reviews with different aspects of ontologies can be reviewed. But you also provide this small, very simple snapshot of the content of the ontology, which is calculated based on the key concepts of the ontology, which are automatically extracted based on a certain number of measures. With this example, we consider that person is the most important concept in the SWRC ontology, second one being publication, and there are some form of relation between person and organization and between publication and document. This provides an extremely simple and informal representation of the ontology, but that the user can very quickly make sense of and can very quickly understand whether this ontology is interesting at least to be explored, or if this ontology will fit together with another ontology is already looking at. Now, one other way I think to help the user, and Michael has been talking a bit about that, is by providing relations between ontologies. This is almost obvious, but if you don't provide information about whether the ontology is the last version of list of versions of ontologies, is the most general one, or is compatible with a number of other ontologies, this might not help a lot. But also, providing these relations and being able to compute them and to understand them is very useful in providing an overview of the entire repository, to be able to see what is the content of the repository and to explore the repository, not only by searching and browsing very locally, but from a very general and top-level overview. So, again, if you look at existing systems, I didn't say that, but we are on slide 7 now. A few systems provide information about relations between ontologies, and generally this information is a very basic one. Import between ontologies is very easy when you work with the old language. Versions, sometimes you can have versioning information provided, I think this is the case in BioPortal, and some of the systems provide ways to get alignment and mapping between ontologies. But here, I would like to talk about some other relations or some more advanced versions of this relation. And the first one is, again, the versioning relation. While this one is very often covered, the problem is that you can express versioning relations in ontologies, but one thing we have seen while looking at a large collection of ontologies is that things like the old primitive called backward compatible with or version info or all these sort of things it is extremely rare that ontology engineer use them. And it happens very often that there is no information encoded in the ontology about whether this ontology is a previous version of another one or a latest version of another one. And but however, if you look again at this sort of collection, you can see that there are lots of different ways, lots of different conventions used to identify versions of ontology. I'm at in slide 8 here, and you can see in this slide a number of examples of all completely different ways to indicate versions of the same ontologies using simple V1.1 or V1.4, up to timestamps in milliseconds, or dates written in letters. And this is causing a lot of problems, which is simply, it is extremely hard to keep track of the history of ontology. It's very hard to understand how an ontology evolved, and it is therefore very hard to understand and to know whether the ontology you are currently using is the latest version, and if this ontology has not been updated since the first time you try to use it. So that is definitely one, that definitely calls for a common standard for identifying versions of ontologies, and I will come back to that. For some ways between ontology repositories to agree on how to identify versions of ontologies. Now, another relation is quite an obvious one, actually, is inclusion. And again, all imports, things like all imports, indicate inclusion, but very often ontologies just copy parts of other ontologies without really importing them. And this is very useful to understand, to know whether you are looking at a smallest part of an ontology which is sufficient for your need, or as the biggest part for which you want the biggest coverage. And there are many different ways in which an ontology can include another. And I will mention only the one, the syntactic one, which is basically you include the same set of axioms, or the semantic one, which is you, if one ontology can entail another one, but to some extent it includes it.
Excuse me, mention that slide 9.
Sorry?
You're on slide 9.
I was on slide 9, sorry. On slide 9. Now I'm going on slide 10. So, the last relation I want to mention, which is not the only one we are looking at, but I think this one is important, and it also relates to what Michael was talking about, is what I will call disagreement and agreement, or compatibility and incompatibility, which there is a very naive way to understand compatibility, which is to use inconsistency. And if you merge two ontologies and you obtain an inconsistent result, there is an obvious contradiction here. However, inconsistency, as said before, is not sufficient, and ontologies can lead to incoherent results, but they can also disagree to some extent in other ways by having disparate modeling, just not conceptualizing the same things in the same way. And there is another notion which is important, is that if two ontologies are not inconsistent with each other, or are not incoherent, or use the same model, sort of modeling, or the same style, that doesn't mean they agree. It means that maybe it simply means that they don't talk about the same thing. So, and there is an important element to understand that some ontologies can neither agree or disagree with each other, or be compatible or incompatible. They can just have nothing to do with each other. But also, some ontologies can agree and disagree at the same time, and possibly on the same thing. And that is an interesting thing and an important thing to realize and to detect. So we have done a bit of work on sort of exercise on formalizing some measures for agreement and disagreement in ontology, which leads to very interesting assessment of elements like consensus. If there is a particular consensus on a given statement or on a given ontology, or if there is a particular controversy. And this is extremely useful in supporting users in realizing whether an ontology is is suitable to be reused or not by showing whether a particular ontology is generally agreed in a given repository or contain controversial statements which might be needed to look at more carefully. So the final element, I mean, all these relations between ontologies certainly need some form of formalization. And I just wanted to mention that we have started this work on building an ontology of relations between ontologies, which include the relations that I mentioned before, plus others like similarity, and that tries to describe these relations in an ontological way, and adding rules into that to be able to reason upon relations between ontologies and infer new relations and being able to manage this relation and explore them to support users in finding ontologies. So this was slide 11, sorry. So going to slide 12, that's basically my last slide, is about a more general issue, which is there are all these repositories going around and all these systems, and they all include different sort of features, most of them not the one that I just mentioned, but at some point they might or might not, and that I think is a general problem for the entire area of ontology repositories, which is the goal is to support ontology engineers in promoting their ontologies and people in reusing ontologies in an appropriate way, then the notification of repositories is not beneficial. And there is certainly a need for these repositories to work together and in particular in deciding common representation for metadata between ontologies, ways to identify versions of ontologies or even ways to identify ontologies and to share ontologies with each other, to share annotations, reviews of ontologies, so that there is this network of repositories that can work together. The last question is a bit of a provocative one, is whether the open ontology repository intends to be the one repository ruling all these systems and putting them together, or one component of this part and one component of this network. I think that's all.
Thank you. Certainly an interesting way to end your talk. I would say, having a single infrastructure, a single set of standards is certainly very important, but at the same time, it has to be an open process whereby these standards are agreed upon. And so the idea of having a single repository doesn't seem to be very realistic, and I don't think it's desirable. A federated collection of loosely coupled ontology repositories seems more reasonable. But that's all a research issue. Now, the next talk is by Kevin Goodyear. Are you here? Did you make it today? Doesn't sound like we have her today. So let's move on to Todd Schneider. This is the last talk in the
channel.
Todd, are you there?
I'm here, Ken.
Okay, so go ahead, Todd.
Am I loud enough?
So, yes, I can hear you. Let's go.
Okay. Well, first, I need to thank Kenneth for reminding me that this presentation was today. Subsequently, some of the questions I have here are less than refined. However, I think you'll find them interesting. In particular, what I found very interesting on the presentations that were given is that there's a common theme that ran across many of them. And that theme had to do with, can I find or can I use one or more ontologies that I've discovered? Will they do what I need them to do? And one of my questions, or at least one of them, looks at that. But let's go on. On to slide 2, has some of the first questions. Here's some more practical questions. Ontologically driven development, or ontology driven development, however you want to pronounce it. Can we do it in the first place? And if you can do it, what are the impacts of that? And by ontologically driven development, I mean you have an ontology for your domain and some other areas in which you need them, and you just press a button and it starts chunking stuff out. Similar to what UML does currently. You draw your nice UML diagram. Most of the tools nowadays will automatically generate code. Well, we'd like to push that one step further. And can we get, for instance, the OOR code automatically generated from an appropriate ontology or ontologies? That's effectively the latter, or plural. Next question related to that is, what infrastructure or supporting ontologies are needed to have this automatic code generation? And how might this notion and the artifacts of it impact existing development tools or paradigms, package name, configuration management? Very practical questions here. How does the impact configuration management distribution? And this, I think, at least referred to in some regards, that is, the shift here from development to the actual use of ontologies. She referred to the issue of incomplete ontology. You gain new knowledge, you need to change things. Well, the goal of an ontology is to help a system operate more effectively or efficiently or better. And if you're then changing the underlying ontology that your system is based on, how can you automatically introduce new additions to your ontology and still have your system perform properly as expected? And this then would come under this guise of ontologically driven development. If your systems are going to be based on ontologies, whatever fashion, you should be able to allow them to evolve without having to go back and spend a month or years in redevelopment. So this is an automatic evolutionary capability that would be introduced by this type of notion. And then the real question is, how much can actually be automated? Can you allow real-time changes? So that's one group of questions. Administration. This particular item, I think, was touched on by almost every speaker in some regard. If the OOR is ontologically driven, then I would assume, in addition to just code generation, the actual administration of it would be based on this also. And Alisa referred to or alluded to this in terms of the policies that should be invoked or enforced to provide the types of quality and services that you'd like to provide. Matthew alluded to this also, to the problem. How can you demonstrate or guarantee that what's being put in there is going to meet your users' needs, or at least meet your quality level standards, if you have any. And necessarily, I think if you have any policies, there's some implicit quality controls that they represent. Can you, what do I say here, can the configuration management be sufficiently automated? Provenance. Now, that, I'll come back to that again, but we heard that same problem crop up in each of the talks, I believe, except maybe Bart's. But it's in there. On to slide 4. Terminology mediation. This gets back to usability. And this actually is a general question. Is terminology and the mediation of different terminologies part of an ontology mapping? I'm not sure how people define it. I've heard different definitions. Should the OOR provide a terminology mediation service? I mean, even the simple-minded view, if things are not developed in English and there are equivalent terms in different languages, should we provide that mediation service? If people are using different terms to refer to the same thing, even if it's in the same natural language, should we have a way to mediate that? And what would such a terminology mediation service look like? I'm not sure. Again, it depends on the goals that you want to support. Is there a supporting ontology or whatever terminology mediation service you want to provide, again, back to ontologically driven development environment. And now, the last one, interpretation. I believe many of the issues that were raised by the previous speakers come down to extra ontological considerations, which some of which can be put into the domain of provenance. However, many of them come down to interpretation. When an ontology is submitted to the repository, should some aspects of its interpretation, which many people refer to as use, be included? I think the answer should be yes, as I think you have garnered from the other speakers. And if so, what should that be? What does it mean to have this usage described? draw it in a formal fashion. Now, the notion of interpretation is something that's greatly overlooked in most all the talks about ontologies and semantic webs, semantic technologies that I hear. Now, I was very heartened when Michael Gruninger gave a talk at the OIC conference, was it last year, I think, where he started talking about interpretation. Now, he gave a description from the mathematical logic perspective, which is very nice. However, there are operational constraints or realities that should be taken into account if we're going to provide this capability, or if you like, require this description provide to be provided with an ontology. So even though I can say my domain is healthcare, is that sufficient for someone to come along and query on ontology and say, oh, this ontology, which is claimed to be derived from healthcare operation, is really going to meet my needs? Just saying you're in healthcare could be insufficient. Are you in an emergency healthcare? Are you in pediatric healthcare? Are you in research healthcare? Is pharmaceuticals part of healthcare? So what should the interpretation of an ontology be? And how can we formalize it? And can we provide policies that would enforce the existence of this interpretation when an ontology is presented for admission to an open ontology, to the repository? Now, if we can come up with some notion in a formal fashion what an interpretation is, then I think we'll be moving closer to the notion of properly describing what a context is. And of course, context, everyone uses it all the time, but it's very hard to formalize. And from a systems perspective, this is something that's really crucial when you're working in an F-centric environment, which is a basic assumption of having ontology and having open ontology repositories. I think that's all I have to say. Oh, one other point about this interpretation and the provenance issue. This is tightly coupled with the search capabilities of any repository. Can you find what you need? Now, the dual to that is, can I specify what I really need? So if we have a way to describe any of the issues that are attributable to perhaps provenance, or as I'm saying here, interpretation, i.e. use of an ontology, then we can make the search more effective and subsequently probably provide users with a better value. I think that's all I have, Ken.
Oh. Okay, thank you, Todd. So that's our last panel member. Actually, that last slide regarding interpretation, Michael, what do you think about this? I would think Common Logic would have, you know, definitely something to say about
this is beyond formal interpretation. This is very simple-minded, pragmatic, operational interpretation. However, I think some of the techniques that Michael was talking about in terms of relative consistency could be applied here.
Yeah, so I had a master's student who just finished last spring, and what he was doing was, you know, using an ontology repository as a way to suggest the axioms that you might want to have. So the idea would be that you would, like most users don't really know logic very well, but they can at least give you like examples and counterexamples of a particular kind of relation. And so what we would do is build models of satisfying interpretation represented kind of graphically. And the student kind of made an algorithm that would search the ontology repository, trying to find the strongest ontology that was consistent with the examples that were being given. So that's kind of an example maybe of what Todd's saying here. That's kind of using formal interpretations represented in a kind of visual way and then using that to determine which ontology best matches with that. Is that kind of what you're thinking of, Todd?
Actually, that's moving in the right direction, but I'm saying that more than that, you have to be, and I'm not clear how to do this, you have to specify the domain and the usage of your ontology in a more formal or complete fashion.
Right.
Now, exactly what that entails, I'm not sure. The suggestion that you have using, it's not pattern matching, what do you call it?
Well, it was kind of building graphical models,
yeah. Yeah, it's looking at analogical reasoning to help narrow down
the possible domains of interpretation.
Right.
Yeah. So again, it's a jump between the formal satisfaction notion of interpretation and the operational notion of satisfaction. Yes, my system works with it, or no, it's going to crash things and do bad stuff. Because an ontology is just a string of characters, and, you know, the real notion of, or the real interpretation comes when you load it onto a system and it performs as expected.
Right, so then I guess the question would be how to capture those kinds of expectations.
Yeah. Whether they're expectations, or maybe that's a good word to put to use there, and how can, or whether that capture can be complete, probably not. Can it be sufficient? Maybe. And analogical reasoning could probably help there, make it easier.
Mm-hmm.
But again,
that's also one reason why we kind of also sometimes use competency questions as ways of kind of saying, you know, to say here are the this ontology is sufficient to be able to address these kinds of queries. And people kind of sometimes, I think, respond better to that sort of description rather than the axioms themselves.
That makes sense.
Yes. The question then becomes, can you list enough those questions that will narrow down the possible interpretation sufficiently?
That's right. Yeah, no, that's true.
Or do I need 1,000 of them?
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're right. That's a very good point.
I just think it popped to mind that Matthew had pointed out in terms of the formalization of this notion. I just escaped it right now. I have to go back and look at his notes, his slides.
But this seems to suggest that competency questions, example usages, those are all, properly part of what you put into an ontology repository.
They should be, yeah.
Yeah. But they have to be tightly coupled to the ontology that they're claiming to be true for.
Yes, of course.
But, yeah, they're part of the metadata, I think, like, as
part
a,
of the metadata.
Kind of identifying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's part of the provenance issue, I would believe. And again, how can we formalize that so we can do some of this somewhat automatically, or at least provide capabilities to automate that at the point when we can do it?
Right. Right.
And if we have that, then we get closer to doing things a lot more automatically and provide this evolutionary, automatic evolution without a lot of extra work. Yeah, I guess it's on Matthew's last slide, no common ways to identify like versions of ontology and be able to share them intelligently. Yeah, okay. Specifically, it says no common representation of the metadata.
But also and suggests that there should be kind of regression testing for ontologies as they go through versions.
Well, I think Michael's work was trying to address some of that, or could be applied to
good,
it.
Yeah.
In a simpler
exactly.
fashion, yeah.
But having, let's move on now.
Okay.
We want to get to the general discussion. If you move back to my slide, the opening slide, maybe we have time to just briefly go through some of these issues. So is everyone on the opening slide deck? Slide number 4. Slide number 4, one of the issues that was brought up in 2008 was the granularity issues, and, you know, logical granularity versus storage granularity. I mean, what are they the same? How does that affect the repository? Are they dependent on languages? Because obviously, as we start moving toward including common logic, the simple issues of granularity start to become a lot more complex. On slide 5, there are, of course, all these language issues, which languages, representation languages, should be supported. Obviously, we'd like to support them all. The real issue is more when will they be supported, to what extent will they be supported. Where do we start, what are the milestones for support of the different languages? Same thing could be asked for search languages, which you have anywhere from informal languages through the more formal languages like Sparkle. And then finally, there's this inter-ontology mapping representation. Now, everybody has been talking about these relationships between ontologies. Should there be just one language for that? Should we allow multiple languages?
And if we do, then which ones should be supported and when should they be supported? Clearly there's some issues here, not just so much about what we want to support, but at what point do we really want these to be supported? That requires that we think a little bit about the priorities for the different issues so that we can, you know, address these issues in a more systematic way. Slide number six, there's internal storage issues. Do we have single representation, multiple representation, since ORs are intended to have multiple instances and to be federated? You might very well represent it one way on one of them and a different way in another. What happens if the representation,
me too, I got my fingers
the
in
multiple
the
representation are lossy when you start translating between them?
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Then, of course, the many management issues that have been discussed quite a great deal. I think those are important. That's slide number seven. Slide number eight is a slide I actually talked about last week. The issue there is just what should be the overall organization of information in the OOR. I suggested that the different domains would have their own domain-specific ontologies, together with metadata or instance data that's outside of the ontology. The dashed line there in that in diagram number eight represents the boundary between the OOR and more specialized storage areas. So the idea there is some very knowledge-intensive applications and domains might actually be stored entirely on the OOR. Others, image data, sensor data, for example, it would not be very realistic to put that into an OR for a variety of reasons. So the idea is to have some kind of boundary between the data and the data and the OOR, and also to have the ability to specify different domains in a fairly systematic structure. I'm not suggesting this is the only structure that we should have. It's just something that I'm suggesting as a first draft. Slide number nine, there is, of course, issues that have been discussed quite a bit, the modularization and mapping issues, so I won't really talk any more about that. But it was already brought up in 2008, no doubt earlier. Slide number 10, this is a more recent issue having to do with the issue of how ontologies are related to web services and more generally software architectures.
This is also related to your languages issue?
Yeah, all of these are interrelated to one another. No
yeah,
question
of
about it. Yeah. Slide number 11, there are tool support issues. Now, these were not discussed too much today. They were brought up in 2008. You know, for an OR to be generally accepted, presumably you have to have these tools to help. And, you know, if you look at the ontology repositories that are out there, they do have a number of these tools. Which ones should be offered? I mean, which ones are people actually using? Which ones are the best? Is it really domain-specific? Should it be up to particular OR instances? Remember that the OR is federated. Should we allow different instances to have their own particular tools for viewing ontologies and making use of them? Perhaps that's a way of dealing with it. Then, of course, there are a number of people that mentioned of administration and policy issues. And then, of course, here's the question. Should there be overall, you know, one ring to rule them all type policies, or should the instances be free to develop their own ontologies within perhaps a common framework? But if there is going to be some kind of overall policy or framework, then we need some kind of policy-making body. When should this be constituted? Who should be on it? You know, that's going to be an issue if the OOR starts to get any kind of traction among other communities. Then scalability issues on slide 13. some ontologies are actually very large. So there's questions of scalability to be able to handle those very large. One way might be to, as on Slack, picture there is to split at one point between the OOR and the instance data so that some other mechanism can be used for handling larger, these very large ontologies. Finally, slide 14, one that I haven't heard anyone talk about is outreach and education. I mean, we want to reach other communities. We need not just documentation, but actual, you know, education and training modules, and perhaps even meeting with representatives of other communities to assist them in transition to an OOR. So, you know, that's clearly there are a number of issues here that have to be addressed. For each one, there's a question of just exactly when it should be done, how important it is, so that we can devote resources to achieving each of these in a systematic way. So it's now 3 o'clock, so it's time, I think, to open up to general questions. For those who wish to ask a question, the best way is to get onto the chat room and to raise your hand. If you've been to a meeting before, you already know how to do this. If you haven't, please look at the chat link on the meeting page and get into the chat room. That's perhaps the best way for you to ask your question right now. So the first person with his hand raised is Robbie. Robbie, would you ask your question now? Robbie, are you
can you hear me now?
Yes, I hear you now, Robbie. So
my first top-level question to the team and especially to you, Ken, is when we see a ray of light or hope that at least the core practicing ontology community would start agreeing on some kind of framework in which they are developing their products, research outputs, or processes, namely ontology. So once we have some kind of reasonable agreement, I mean, it need not be perfect, need not be 100% participation, then at least we can start placing conceptually where what ontologies belong. And then, of course, domain is one such concept, but let's take biology itself. I mean, are we talking of an organism living in another organism as a parasite, etc.? Are we talking of botany? How does it relate? Is it about food usage? It's a plethora of interrelationships and interconnections. So is there somewhere, and when you say upper ontology, you mean you would connect them downstream from coarser to their more granular concepts. So when is there hope of industry or community agreed framework? Or there are many, and I just don't know about them.
You asked a lot of tough questions.
I'm sorry.
But, I have personally been very concerned about the, as you know from running this session, the research issues. It would be good if we didn't continually reinvent the wheel and we were more systematic in our research efforts. There's, you know, as you know, there are a whole lot of ontology registries and repositories out there. It really doesn't make sense for this kind of work to be done and redone continually. And the same thing with research, you know, it'd be nice to be able to have some way of specifying what the research objectives are, in the main research objectives, what the priorities are, so that we can you can address them in a systematic way, which is not to suggest that we shouldn't allow people, multiple people, to work on the same problem, but rather that we at least have some mechanism for expressing what, you know, what our main problems are. You know, and then, you know, of course, keep communication going so that different individuals will know what other people are doing.
At least a navigation roadmap. If somebody starts an ontology, they go on some kind of a map, like we go for a place on a global map and say, this is what I am talking about, this place, this season, this time of the year. Similar such concepts that our communities agree on, so that there is some hope someday of reuse or at least interoperability.
Yes. I think that that is definitely one of the objectives of what we're talking about here. Does anyone else have a comment about that on the panel? Okay, then, Bart, you have your hand up?
Yes, thanks, Ken. Just to go back to some of the comments and questions about the intentions of an ontology or the intuitions. Some of the work I'm doing is looking at the instances or the experiences of the ontologist and try to infer some information from that in patterns and, you know, characteristics and include them in ontologies in order for to describe what the ontologist is supposed to be describing, I guess. So not only looking at the ontology itself, but having it guide other groups and, you know, external parties, and be able to determine what the ontology is talking about, what was the intended use of it, and doing that semi-automatically based on the instances and the rules and the granules they were derived from the instances.
So, Bart?
Yes.
This is Don Schneider. That's very interesting. I mean, that would certainly get close to what I was talking about in terms of interpretation, having access to the instances. But I don't know if OOR could provide that. Well, I guess they could provide that service, assuming the instance data was available. However, I can think of many scenarios where whoever owns that instance data will not allow OOR to touch it, but if we provided them with a tool, they might be able to run it on that data and then derive the interpretation or the intent from it. And then if we had a way to represent that intent properly, provide that to the OOR.
So actually, you're this. No, sir, go ahead. No, that's actually exactly the purpose of what I'm trying to build for OOR. So as someone is adding their or building an ontology to be added, they actually run an algorithm on the data set or whichever part of it they want, and have that tool extract information that doesn't reveal anything important about the data, but actually give clues about the ontology itself and about the intended use of it.
Well, that'd be excellent.
There's some work that has been done on this in the data mining field, and I'm looking at that right now, and see how I can use it for specifically for ontology mapping, actually. So I'm glad that you mentioned that.
If you can generate that data, the next challenge is to figure out how to represent that more specifically. It doesn't necessarily have to be an ontology, but from a configuration management and a policy perspective in terms of provenance, what are those aspects or attributes that need to be specified sufficiently to allow that ontology to be put in, and then conversely to facilitate searches and guarantee a good result.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually a lot. I'm looking at that right now to figure out how to choose the attributes and what aspects of the information are actually important and needed. Yeah, so that's it's in the works, and if anyone is available to or volunteering their time to collaborate on this kind of module for OR, I'd be more than happy to share my my research with them.
Thanks. Any more comments about that? Okay. The next hand is from Mike Bennett.
Hi. Can you hear me, or do I have to dial 3?
We can hear you.
Oh, hang on. Oh, good. Oh, good, because I was struggling to get the right window for the start. Sorry about that. Yeah, I just wanted to throw an idea into the mix. I've kind of maybe duplicating what some people have already said, but all these different kind of tags or sort of meta properties of ontologies, and I think picking up what was said earlier, are we looking at really what would be a standardization of, say, you know, a set of standard terms which, you know, independently of the language, but then, for example, in OWL, they would be implemented using a standard set of OWL annotation properties or something, so that we'd be looking at a kind of a, in the same way that in a UML modeling tool you would create tag values as a meta model around your model, are we looking at perhaps trying to standardize on tags such as for provenance of meanings, provenance of instancing, version management, and various other things as well?
Well, I think the answer is yes, but I don't know if tagging is the appropriate notion.
Mm.
They are attributes of the ontology, or its instance data, and or its usages that you need to capture to allow a potential reuse of it that's going to be effective, among other things.
Right. What about attributes at the level of classes and relationships and things?
I'm not sure what you mean.
The provenance of a term. So you say, well, this term, which is accrued interest, comes from the XBRL standard, whereas this term, which is interest accrual, comes from Mike Bennett's head and has no other provenance.
That's an interesting question. We need to have that, or at least it would be desirable to have that, to understand the provenance of each concept and each relation, each other thing that's part of the formal ontology. How we go about doing that, not clear. Do we require that each ontology have all of these appropriate fields built in if they're supported by the language, which is another issue? And if they are supported by the language, how do we go and check them and say, this is, okay, there's a string in there. What do I know about the string? At least there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
I think
that's the kind of thing I'm thinking of, and things like adding synonyms for business reviewability instead of simply using the RDFS label, for example, in the OWL RDF world. I've been able to take an ontology and have to add certain kinds of tag values, if you like, to extend the nature of what's shown and how it's shown. And it would be great to have some standardized structure for that. Really, I'm just thinking out loud and wondering if other people are sort of thinking the same thing.
Well, I think you probably heard from most of the speakers that something like that is needed. Exactly what it should be and the form it should take and language dependence have yet to be resolved. I guess some of the work that's done by ISO, and I, at least it referred alluded to some of it, is probably applicable here.
Very much so.
And then we get to the education part. Yes, this is probably a good thing to have. How do we get people to actually go out and do it? But again, that would come down to the policy issue and enforcement of policies that we have or don't have. It's going to be an evolving thing, so I can see that as we learn how to do these, get consensus on what should be done, then there's going to be the configuration issue of, well, we have all this old stuff sitting around. It doesn't conform to what we now think should be done. What do we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix it, kick it out, start again, or label it as such, back to versioning? And the OR itself will have versions, policies will have versions, and so on.
And I'd love to be involved with something like that. What I wouldn't want to do is either sort of barge ahead and throw stuff together that's already being done, or miss the boat where it's being done. But if there's a thing that needs being done and isn't being done, then count me in.
I heard a volunteer there. I'm pretty sure we have witnesses now.
Oh, okay. There are actually a number of interesting conversations going on in the chat room. Bart, you said that I do not have a question, right?
Yeah, sorry, I haven't figured out how to put my hand down yet, so just disregard that.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yes?
Yeah, this is Todd. I'm behind a firewall, so I cannot see the chat. Is there any synopsis you could give us of the high points?
Yeah, let me... There was a question that... Mike and Robbie brought up concerning my diagram that it doesn't show anything about the relationships between the ontologies, and that's true. It was too complicated to try to get that into the diagram, but obviously, you know, inter-ontology relationships is crucial for interoperability. It's just difficult to put that into a diagram without making it, you know, impossible to read. On the other hand, there is a question about, I was looking at this from the point of view of a couple of NSF programs called, one of them is called DataNet and the other is Interop. And basically their idea is that there are these research communities that are producing large amounts of data, and there's a recognition that, you know, we really need to be able to interoperate between, say, different individuals within the same community producing data of the same kind, as well as between different communities, and that metadata annotations are the way to do this. But now, do we approach this from a kind of top-down approach and mandate that all scientists start from some, scientific communities start from some upper ontology and identify their particular niche gradually from the top down? Or, which is actually the case, they tend to run relatively independently of one another. And then it's sort of after the fact that they have to grapple with the question of how they're going to interoperate. I don't know that we can mandate any particular approach to how people do things. All we can do is provide, you know, some infrastructure and mechanism to help them, you know, achieve interoperability and appropriate metadata annotation.
Well, we can't mandate that, but NSF can.
I don't
right?
know.
You want our money? Do it our way, or?
Yeah, well, it was somewhat disconcerting after we submitted our DataNet proposal, and the reviewers unanimously agreed that the OOR, they used terms like essential and crucial, and then turned down the proposal. Wait a minute. Am I missing something here? What?
Oh, this is Pat Caffey. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. On that question of point, the what do you do about people developing their own ontologies and how to interact? As I've mentioned many times before, I think the only serious potential for accurate interoperability is for everybody to relate their ontologies to a common foundational ontology. That doesn't mean you can't develop an ontology independently, but if you want to interoperate with others, what you have to do is at least identify the top elements, whatever your hierarchy is, the top elements, how they relate to you, and also determine whether or not your relations relate to the relationship that you're going to use. The project can be done post-hoc a lot easier than done from the start. The other question about mandating. And that thing about NSF, it's not a joke, actually. I think the NSF should, at some point, when a substantial community agrees upon a foundation ontology, the NSF may well mandate that that certain fraction, at least, of research that involves ontologies be referenced to a common foundation ontology. You wouldn't want all of it to be done. You'd want to be opportunity open for the and especially people a lot of to, but at the end, they have to set aside some proportion of their money that was going to go to ontology work. Say 10% or 20%. But these grants only go to somebody who uses these particular ontologies. I think we'd get a lot of people using the same ontology. And all this nonsense about, oh, please let me get people to agree to precisely that. If you want them to agree, you pay them.
Good point. Yeah, there was a recent National Academy report that came out. I think it was just a week and a half ago, maybe? Something like that. Very recent. That mentioned, it was just almost all about metadata and how important it was and how different scientific disciplines had to strongly encourage their all of their researchers to make their data not only available but to annotate it with appropriate metadata. But the article stopped short of really going into any detail about that. I mean, they talked about metadata, but they didn't talk too much about, for example, they didn't use the word ontology. I think they used the word ontology once, and it was kind of in a parenthetical comment. So there's definitely a lot of interest in this, but whether it gets to the issue of, you know, whether it starts to actually mandate ontologies or mandate use of some common upper ontology, I don't see anything like that right now.
Yeah, I think what might well be feasible is that if any particular piece of research is going to use an ontology or just a database, data representation, that the NSF might very well mandate that it use some common upper ontology, some approved upper ontology. So there may be several communities that might decide to run off and make their own. Okay, as long as there is a small finite number that people can use for testing purposes, without that, it's just not going to get to the profitability. There are a number of people talking about relationships beyond that. And there are some that are fairly straightforward. You know, if one ontology includes another, you know, now ontology includes another, okay, pretty straightforward. And if as Mike talked about, some ontologies are definably interpretable with respect to other ontologies, and those are meaningful relationships. But now, if they have two separately dependent and developed ontologies, you may have 5,000 terms in each, and each of these ontologies, maybe 1,000 terms, maybe more or less related in some not exactly clear way to the 1,000 terms in other ontologies. I see no possibility that these things are done that without a really serious effort, a stringent definition of what things mean, how they relate to each other in logic terms. Just reuse. Maybe okay for search. You know, there are some applications like search where you just do a statistical approach and you come out with a list of possibilities that come in from that area. That's fine. But not for a machine. You know, a decision by itself. We need to compromise this. So I think some relationship to some common foundation ontology can be more than one. But that, I think, is really a way we should be at least making serious look at before you dismiss it.
Okay, and I'd like to switch the discussion a little bit to something that was on the chat board a little earlier. Lisa, you had some comment there. You still there?
Yeah. I'm Lisa. Here.
Yeah. You had an interesting discussion on the chat board.
Ken?
Yes?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking Elisa Kendall.
Oh, sorry.
But you were involved in that as well.
Which issue, Ken? On my response to Michael?
There was a response to Michael? Right. Did you finish? Did you resolve that?
I think so, although I did not say... I actually agree with him that the metadata doesn't necessarily provide as much as he might need in terms of, you know, what exact relationships you care about. And one of the things, I mean, we can talk about dependencies between ontologies. We can make general relationships that are important from a, you know, who's calling whom, who uses which term and what other ontology perspective. That's a lot more straightforward than understanding the conceptual relationships that are domain-specific or that may be mathematically grounded or something else. Those are a lot harder. And so it could be that what Michael was interested in was something deeper like that. And I don't think in the projects I'm working on that we're trying to do that, at least not at this first blush early stage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that was actually very helpful to clarify that point. Excellent.
I think there's still a lot of research questions. In other words, depending on what domain you're working in, what you're trying to do, what your use cases are, what your competency questions are, the whole notion of being able to at least state some set of competency questions, especially if you could use those as a basis for regression testing, is very interesting.
Yes, and then you were responding to Ravi and to Joel?
So Joel was interested in how you even go about, at least if I'm interpreting correctly, how you would even go about representing provenance at various levels. And for our purposes, we have kind of two levels of provenance that really look very much like that diagram in your slide, where you have some set of metadata about the ontology itself and some set of annotations that might be either inside or attached to a particular ontology that would provide some of that detail. And what you would ideally want to do is have the annotations be represented in the same ontology representation language as the ontology itself, and maybe provide some set of templates people can use in order to do that. But you might want to maintain the annotations outside the ontology. BioPortal started to do something along these lines, and I've talked to Natasha a little bit about it, and they were really trying to provide some way for people to annotate ontologies and associate those annotations with the specific versions. In the work that they're doing there and the research in that arena is very relevant to what we're talking about here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Although, I'm not sure. To what extent does BioPortal support the idea of annotations of data that's outside of BioPortal?
So you can do that.
I mean, I'm sure you
can. You can. Although the demonstration I saw was of work in progress at an OMG meeting last year. And so I do not know how much of that has been incorporated in their current publicly available tool.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't taken a look recently, I'll be honest about that. We've been pretty swamped, so I haven't had a chance to see how far they've gotten.
Yeah, okay. And Ravi even made the point, why, you know, shouldn't we do the annotation before we do the sensing?
Well, so at JPL, the approach we want to take is to provide some set of processes, right? When you submit something to go into a registry, you already have to provide at least some minimal set of annotations to go with it. So it's all part of the submission process, the governance process, the revision process. Maybe once you've submitted something to a repository inside an organization like that, you could then run some set of tests on the ontology itself to see if they've met all the requirements of the process, and possibly other tests to see if we add annotations or add metrics or other things based on some independent set of evaluation algorithms. And then you would include all of that metadata as part of the set of annotations that you would provide. But that's a long ways off, at least from our perspective at KPL.
Yeah, I have the same feeling that it would be a tremendous change in attitude.
So you need an organization like JPL who has serious requirements for integrity in their data and for data accountability and for providing that at a governmental level. I mean, you really need that level of requirement and commitment, I think, in order to get to that place. Which is why the public sector is a place where I think these kinds of requirements will come sooner than from the commercial world.
In any case, it's now 3:30. We've reached our time limit. I noticed there's still some questions. I think you're going to have to handle those questions offline, Ravi and Joel.
Okay.
It is so. I believe it's time now that we will adjourn. Hopefully, we can come back to these questions again. It sounds like there's a lot more to discuss and a lot more issues.
Great session. I just want to thank you all, and especially to you.
No. Thank you, Ravi. So everybody, it's now time to adjourn. Thank you. Thanks to all the panelists and. And to all the participants.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
very much. Thank you.